Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, March 23, 2020, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled Courthouse Decision on Collar v. Kansas. My name is Micah Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Giancarlo Canaparo, who is a legal fellow at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. Giancarlo, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Micah. Today, this morning, the Supreme Court issued an opinion in the case of Collar versus Kansas. And the overview is that it held in a 6-3 opinion by Kagan, joined by Roberts, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, that the Due Process Clause does not require the states to adopt a specific insanity defense to criminal liability. So I'm going to start out by a brief discussion of the facts of the case, because the nature of the respondent defendant below, Mr. Collar's mental illness, is relevant to this inquiry. And in his case, what he did is he had what he described as a psychotic break. And after a long and very messy divorce, custody proceedings and battles, he went to his former mother-in-law's house, where his ex-wife or estranged wife and children were, and went to the house and shot every member of his family who was there besides his son, who he allowed to leave. He was charged with capital murder. And he wanted to argue that his psychotic break, although it did not allow him to appreciate the wrongness or moral culpability of what he did, although he did form the intent to premeditated murder, he formed the requisite mens rea. He did not know at the time that what he was doing was morally wrong. Now, this matters because under what we would call the traditional or common insanity defense, proof of insanity renders one incapable of being convicted. You are not guilty by reason of insanity. Kansas had changed its insanity defense. What Kansas allows a party to do is to use the evidence of insanity to defeat the mens rea. However, it is not in accordance with the traditional or more commonplace insanity defense where you are not guilty by reason of insanity. It only is allowed at the pre-sentencing stage to defeat mens rea. It is allowed, evidence of mental defect is allowed then again at the sentencing stage as a reason to judge someone not fully capable, to lessen his punishment, to have someone sent to a mental hospital instead of a prison, that sort of thing. Now, he wanted at trial to raise the traditional insanity defense, and that was shot down by the trial judge in Kansas because that had been abolished. And he raised the argument on appeal that the Due Process Clause and the Eighth Amendment actually mandates a particular insanity defense, mandates exculpation when one is not morally cognizant or doesn't know that what one has done is morally wrong. So that was the issue. Does the Due Process Clause and the Eighth Amendment, do they require a particular formation of the insanity defense, specifically the one which is not guilty by reason of insanity, hinging on moral knowledge or moral culpability? The Supreme Court said no. And it's an interesting opinion. It's written by Justice Kagan. Interesting to start off with what it does not do. And as explanation, I'll say that my colleague Paul Larkin and I wrote a law review article published in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy a few months ago on this case. And what we did is started out with an originalist understanding of the Due Process Clause. What is it that the text of the clause say? Does the text mandate a particular substantive rule for state criminal law? And of course it doesn't. But what's really interesting about Kagan's opinion is that that's not where she starts. She does not start with the text, and I'll get to a theory about why that is. But she says simply that she starts off with the rule in due process cases, which is, she says, it sets a high bar. A substantive criminal provision or criminal rule of liability. Only violates due process if it, quote, offends some principle of justice so rooted in tradition and consciousness of our people as to be ranked fundamental. And then she goes through a variety of cases, including Powell and Clark, where the Supreme Court has said that substantive rules of criminal law, especially in the context of the insanity defense, they raise uncertainties about the human mind. There's an interrelationship between insanity, morality, criminal culpability, and, of course, psychological understandings of what it means to be insane, so that these are issues that must be left for the state government, not constitutional law. So Kagan frames this opinion as one very much in line with existing precedent. We don't have to do much. We don't have to reinvent the wheel here. We're not going far beyond where we have been before. This is a matter pretty much of rote precedent. And she turns to the history of the insanity defenses. And this is interesting because any due process argument like this is going to rely very heavily on historical arguments because the standard is one, it's something rooted in the tradition and consciousness of the people. So there's this debate that goes on between the majority opinion and the dissent by Breyer, joined by Sotomayor and Ginsburg, about what is the history of the insanity defense. Is this moral culpability element a required part of it? And throughout the opinion, Kagan reminds the reader that this is a really high bar. It must be absolutely rooted in tradition. It cannot be even the favored standard of many available standards. It must be the bedrock of our understanding. And that's really where the debate comes down between the dissent and Justice Kagan. And Justice Kagan goes through the history, and in my opinion, she's got the better argument here than the dissent, that since the earliest British legal scholars started writing about the nature of the insanity defense, there's been a huge debate. Is it purely limited to cognition? That is, are you aware of what you're doing? Are you able to form the intent required? Is it volition? Is it morality? There's this great debate. And for a while, coming out of the famous McNaughton text, early 1800s in Britain, there was this element of morality. And that really swept the nation for a while, until it didn't. Then you had a volitional test. You had morality, the appreciation of morality with an appreciation of legality. And so she goes through this history and shows that even if the morality standard has been sort of the go-to standard, or the most preferred standard, it is not one so deeply rooted in the nation's history that it must be fundamental, that crystallizing it in a constitutional rule is mandated by the due process clause. And she goes through a policy-based rationale for this as well, which is over time, our understanding of what mental illness is and what it means is constantly changing. The law is constantly in what she calls a dialogue with the field of psychology to understand what insanity is. But the legal determination of insanity for the purposes of escaping criminal liability or mitigating criminal punishment is not purely a psychological question. It is as much a question of a particular group of people or state conception of morality. And when does insanity excuse one from the moral repercussions that are wrapped up in criminal sanction? And she says that this dialogue, this tension between morality and the legal ramifications of psychology and the nature of this in the scientific understanding of insanity is one of a constant give and tug, a pull back and forth, one which must be open to experimentation in the state laboratories and to impose, to pick one determination of how those things interact. And to constitutionalize it freezes it in time, like one written in stone. It would end the ability of states to experiment. It would end our ability for the law to react to developments in psychological understanding, for the people as organizing the states to have shifting conceptions of when punishment should adhere to particular conduct, when conduct is morally blameworthy. And what she says, what Kansas has done is shifted, is to say that when one commits a crime with the intent, even if one doesn't know that it's morally wrong, it should still be punished. And she's not prepared to say, the majority is not prepared to say that that is a judgment, a moral judgment, which the court can set aside. And the court cannot impose its own moral judgment on them. And she comes out, the dissent is pretty hard, and says that's what they're doing. They are substituting their moral judgment for Kansas's. And you can't do that. And what's more, the history is not on your side. We have been wrestling with this back and forth for years, hundreds of years back. So that's how this breaks down, essentially this debate between cognitive impairments and cognitive insanity and moral insanity, or the standard, whether it's cognitive or moral. The dissenters go through the history, and they view it differently. And I think that in the later portions of her opinion, Kagan responds very well to these arguments. And they say that the focus has always been on morality, and it hasn't. Further, Kagan will concede is that it's messy. But a lot of the history focuses on cognition, on the ability to form mens rea. And she says, look, ultimately, even if the dissent is correct that there's a favoring of a morality-based test, it's not overwhelmingly the case. And in fact, there are 21 states that don't require a morality-based approach. There are 4 others that follow what Kansas has done. There are 16 that follow an approach that asks whether the defendant knew that what he was doing was illegally wrong. And she says, and the dissent concedes this point, that if the court were to invalidate Kansas's approach, it would very necessarily have to invalidate any other approach that didn't expressly embrace this morality-based approach. So that's how that case shakes out. So the court says, look, we're not going to get involved in these sort of substantive determinations, provided that a state has made some provision for insanity, that some form of defense, whether it's cognitive-based and it's sentencing or sentencing, to finish that thought, a state has to do something, but they're going to give the state a great deal of leeway in how to do it. It's very important to Justice Kagan's opinion that evidence of insanity is permissible at the sentencing stage here. What this means going forward is that I think that this is probably what Kansas has done is quite possibly the outer limit of what the Supreme Court will allow a state to do in terms of limiting the use of insanity evidence. But it's what's important to note, Justice Kagan goes out of her way to say here, is that the caller framed this issue as Kansas abolishing the insanity defense. And that's not what they've done. And you'll see this in the news about this. CNN just put up an article framing the issue this way, too, that Kansas abolished the insanity defense. And that's not what they did. What they did was they did abolish, in a sense, that common articulation of the insanity defense, but they've preserved an insanity defense. They just framed it a different way. You can use evidence of insanity to defeat mens rea and to defeat and to mitigate sentences or to advocate for an alternative sentence. But the defense itself is preserved, and the court makes clear that you will need something. Some sort of insanity defense is required, but this court is not going to mandate one or the other because that laboratory that the states provide for substantive criminal law development would be eliminated. The next question before the court was the Eighth Amendment, and the court didn't address that. It wasn't properly on appeal. Caller also argued for the first time at the Supreme Court level that the Eighth Amendment requires the insanity defense to consider whether he was morally aware or aware that what he was doing was morally wrong. The court didn't take up the question because it wasn't properly raised, but that means that question is still very much live. I'm sure we'll see it again because, like I said, Kansas and 4 other states follow this approach. And that question, in my opinion, is clearer than even the due process one. The Eighth Amendment has to do with punishment, not conviction. And what Caller argues is that it is punishment itself to be convicted of a crime, to bear the moniker guilty, even if you're not sent to prison, if you're sent to a mental institution later. So his argument is that you cannot be convicted, period, under the Eighth Amendment, even if no subsequent punishment follows. We'll see what happens with that issue. It's very much live. It will undoubtedly come up, probably in another capital case, because that's where we see insanity raised most often and with the highest stakes. Because in his case, for instance, he's now facing the death penalty that was given to him by the jury even after hearing the evidence of his mental insanity. So that's what we're looking forward to in future cases on this issue, and that's where this stands. So going forward, the last point I want to make is the elephant in the room in this case was substantive due process. And this is, Collar didn't frame his case that way, and the Supreme Court didn't take the case or address the case that way, but ultimately what his case boiled down to was a substantive due process claim. He didn't argue that, say, the legislator was biased in the trial process against someone like him who tried to assert a insanity defense. He didn't argue that somehow his process was procedurally unfair. He argued that the substance of criminal law doesn't allow him to show that he's morally blameless and that that's not right and that's not constitutional. Ultimately, Collar's case boils down to a substantive due process claim, because what he has argued is that as a substantive matter, the due process clause requires a particular insanity defense. I think Justice Kagan sort of went out of her way to studiously avoid that by framing this case as a matter of well-established prior precedent. So it's conceivable that, I don't want to pretend to read the tea leaves, but that's sort of the elephant in the room that was not addressed in this case. And so we're looking forward to potential future developments there and in the Eighth Amendment space in terms of the insanity defense. With that, I'll open it up to questions.
There's our first question, so we'll go ahead and move to that first question.
So how does this relate to Arizona's perhaps somewhat unique scheme of guilty except insane, which again sort of fails to address the culpability part of the
Yeah, so the guilty but mentally ill or guilty but insane verdict, the long and short of it is it's probably safe. That particular verdict has existed for a very long time and is probably even better established in the historical practice than Kansas's approach. So I think that that approach is going to be safe because, again, it provides some defense for insanity. It provides some mechanism for the criminal justice system to account for insanity, to deal with it. And in fact, it probably provides, in most circumstances, greater protection for a criminal defendant than Kansas's approach. Without going into too much detail, that we do discuss that particular verdict in some detail in our law review article. Again, if you want to check that out, it's from Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy. It's on their homepage there. So if you want to see that, I would recommend that. The article is called A Criminal Bad or Mad.
All right. Not seeing any other questions, hop in. Giancarlo, is there anything else you want to discuss or any closing remarks for us today?
No, thank you very much, and thank you all for joining me, and please stay safe and healthy.
All right, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.